Hello, very good morning, and thank you for joining us here on The Very Last Word.
This is The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
On today's show, our resident tech expert Andy O'Donoghue talks about plans for a new ethical and sustainable smartphone. The best-selling author Rob Doyle shares with us some of his favourite movies, music, television and more in this week's Culture Club. Michael Sheridan brings us the latest in motoring news. And Dee Malumbi and Brian Lloyd look back at the career of the late Monty Python star Terry Jones.
The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
And Volkswagen. Introducing the ID3, the next word in electric vehicles.
It's time for the Culture Club, and I'm delighted to be joined by one of Ireland's most innovative and finest of creative writers. Indeed, he teaches creative writing at the University of Limerick. He also writes a weekly books column for the Irish Times, lives much of his year in Berlin, but he's just published, following his first novel, Here Are the Young Men, which was then followed by This Is the Ritual. He's published Threshold, which, Rob Doyle, is it a novel or is it a, what is it?
Well, this is the question. I feel a kind of sense of glee and victory that I've written a book of which many of the reviews have gone out. A lot of them spend about a quarter or half of the review asking exactly that question, what kind of book it is. But I'm calling it a novel. To be honest with you, Matt, I don't really mind what people call it. All I was trying to do was to write a read, you know, a good read, something that people could really get into and be immersive. But it would be dishonest to call it a memoir because it has fictional elements. And
aren't all memoirs, though, comprised of fictional elements that people tend to dress up their own life story to create an impression for others, which may not necessarily be the reality of what happened?
This is true. I've just taken that and made it a bit more explicit. So there's lots of straightforward autobiography in there, or as straightforward as, you know, there's lots of stuff in there that
straightforward
really did
lies.
There's straightforward fabrication. Yeah, hence my use of the phrase fiction or calling it a novel. But I suppose my definition of a novel, as I say in the book, it's anything I tell it to be. You know, novel, the word novel connotes novelty, newness, freshness. And so I feel if you're writing a novel, it doesn't have to have the same structure and obey the same conventions and rules as, you know, lots of other novels do. So this one, it kind of blends, travel, humor, narrative, confession, fiction, all of these things, criticism, you know, philosophical ideas into one big kind
of... That's a big canvas.
It's a big canvas. It is, yeah. I mean, 3-4 years working on this book, really. So I really put everything I kind of know and love and care about.
But the end objective of what? I mean, it strikes me it's actually very entertaining. Yeah. And is that important to you as well as a writer, that ultimately, as well as engaging maybe the senses and the intellect of the readers, you also entertain them?
Yes. I have a terrible fear of being a bore, even for one sentence. I can't let that happen. So, I think the best art for me manages to be entertaining and more than entertaining at the same time. In other words, it can engage the emotions and the intellect, as you say, and it can really get into some fairly deep territory of life, of selfhood, of what it is to be a human being, the human condition. But at the same time, it can, you know, be very entertaining and funny. And so I like to think I've written not just this book, but all my books would try to be a mixture of those two.
Well, before we get to the music and the movies and television, all those things, what are the books that you love? And if you were been forced, as we've asked you to do, to pick out favourite authors and favourite books, what would you go for?
Well, I mean, there are so many, you know, of course. Reading is my kind of lifeblood in terms of my own creative imagination to keep it fed. But so one that came to mind would be the Chilean novelist, Roberto Bolaño. He's a huge inspiration to me, a great wild storyteller. The weirdo's weirdo, as I've come to think of him. He's a complete maniac who somehow could channel that mania into writing dazzling stories and novels. He would be one. Borges, the Argentinian, would be another. recently Svetlana Alexievich, the I think she's a Belarusian woman who won the Nobel Prize for such books as The Unwomanly Face of War. Again, she's people contest what kind of genre she's writing in. Is it nonfiction? Should she have won the Nobel Prize because it's, is it just journalism? People don't know what to make of her, but her books are very affecting, and that's all that matters at the end of the day to me, really.
We have an extract from the audiobook, The Unwomanly Face of War, so let's just hear it.
And I would discover that in war, there is, apart from death, a multitude of other things. There is everything that is in our ordinary life. War is also life. I would run into countless human truths, mysteries. I would ponder questions the existence of which I had never suspected. For instance, why is it that we are not surprised at evil? Why this absence in us of surprise in the face of evil? A road and many roads. Dozens of trips all over the country. Hundreds of recorded cassettes. Thousands of yards of tape. 500 meetings after which I stopped counting. Faces left my memory. Only voices remained. A chorus resounds in my memory. An enormous chorus. Sometimes the words almost cannot be heard. Only the weeping. I confess, I did not always believe that I was strong enough for this path, that I could make it, could reach the end. There were moments of doubt and fear when I wanted to stop or step aside, but I no longer could. I fell captive to evil. I looked into the abyss in order to understand something.
Tell me a little bit more about that, Rob Doyle, that book. What's The Unwomanly Face of War. What's the background to it?
So this is an author. She's an elderly lady now, but she's a woman who, as a journalist in Soviet Russia in, I think, the late 70s, she was looking around and she was reading all these great war books. And she basically realized that war was always, even in the literature she loved and admired, was always recounted from a male perspective. And it had never been really told, particularly the Second World War, from a woman's perspective. And so she made it her mission and an obsession it became for her to kind of travel the length and breadth of Russia and speak to the women who had lived through the war, whether they were soldiers, and a lot of them were, snipers, medics, whether they were just civilians, all of these different people. And essentially from these amassed voices, I think she did hundreds, if not thousands, of interviews. And from these amassed voices, she kind of put them all together into this epic chorus of voices, of narratives, of stories. But the fascinating thing, and what makes it so different from all the other war books I've ever read, is that in telling their stories, these women, they're not really talking about the names of the generals and the battalions that moved here and there. They're just talking about the human truth,
the consequences,
the horror, the full severity of the horror of, you know, families being torn apart, of people being tortured. And I mean, the war, as we all know, the Second World War in Russia was brutal beyond anything we can almost imagine. But also, you know, the tenderness, the frailty, the compassion. I would kind of defy anybody to read that book and not be shaken, really moved by it. It has that kind of Russian grandeur of spirit to it.
But just as somebody who writes with real beauty and flair, just going through Threshold, your new book, how much do you trust translations of books from other languages? Everyone that you've mentioned there writes in a different language and is translated into English. So, I mean, if your work has been translated into their languages, how well do you think would it actually translate? The substance of the story might be there, the expression, but do you actually get the real use of the language?
Well, this is a good question, and it is one I've thought about, because as you point out, I definitely do a hell of a lot of reading in translation. And I used to, probably when I was younger, I would just read work in translation without really questioning it too much. I would just take it at face value. But now I've read For example, an author like Borges, the great Argentinian genius, I've read various translations of the same short stories, and they can be very different. And so you realize that translation is an art, so much so that with my favorite authors in translation, I've started to know who my favorite translators are and so on. So I think the best translators tend to be writers in their own right. They tend to be poets or novelists or something, who so that you know that they
they're sympathetic to.
They're sympathetic to the needs of not just narrative and storytelling, but language itself.
Okay, Rob Doyle is with us for the Culture Club. I'm going to move off books and I'm going to move to television. We asked you to nominate a television show that you loved as a child, as a teenager, because that can often inform what you go on to enjoy as an adult. You've picked The X-Files. Why so?
Oh, because I was a kid and a teenager in the 90s. And when The X-Files came out, it completely blew me away. You know, who knows? You probably have listeners of a whole big age range, but some of them won't even remember this show, and some will, and some will have the same nostalgic fondness for it as I did. There was nothing like it at the time. It seemed so very dark and so paranoid and edgy and just fascinating that it had a whole kind of mythos and a whole aesthetic that went with it. And
well, let's hear a scene from The X-Files featuring David Duchovny as Mulder, Gillian Anderson as Scully.
Hey, Mulder, it's me. What are you doing?
I'm working at the computer. What are you doing?
I'm packing. Just, you know, getting ready for our trip back to D.C. tomorrow.
You know, Scully, I was just thinking about Lazarus, Ed Wood, and those tofurkey-eating zombies. How come when people come back from the dead, they always want to hurt the living?
Well, that's because people can't really come back from the dead, Mulder. I mean, ghosts and zombies are just projections of our own repressed, cannibalistic, and sexual fears and desires. They are who we fear that we are at heart, just mindless automatons who can only kill and eat.
Party pooper. Well, I got a new theory. I say that when zombies try to eat people, that's just the first stage. You see, they've just come back from being dead, so they're going to do all the things they missed from when they were alive. So first they're going to eat, then they're going to drink, then they're going to dance and make love.
Oh, I see. So it's just that we never get to stay with them long enough to see the gentler side of the undead.
Exactly.
Great. Taking me right back.
What was so great about it? It was sort of quite nonsensical in some respects. And well, there was not a lot of bull in relation to what they were talking about.
Well, you see, I was kind of an age young enough. When I was a kid, I was very into the paranormal. And I was the kind of nerdy kid who would like look at the sky for UFOs and kind of keep notes of what I was seeing and stuff. And then you had this show, which seemed incredibly adult and grown up and sophisticated at the time, much like the clip we've just heard. And it kind of fed into that part of my imagination. But also, I think it was just that wonderful dynamic of those two main actors, you know, David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. And everyone, all the boys had a crush on Gillian Anderson, and all the girls, no doubt, had a crush on Fox Mulder.
We're going to move now to music for your selections. And I'm going to start with the best gig you're at, because from reading Threshold, it's quite clear you're all into very sensual stuff. And Leonard Cohen at the Royal Hospital Kilmainham in June 2008 is something you've picked out as the best gig you were at, presumably for the sort of almost sensual experience of it.
For everything, for the sheer perfection of the night. I remember being at that gig. I think he played three nights there. And yeah, like you say, it was just over a decade ago. And I remember it was this sunny day and it was this outdoor gig. The sound was perfect. And then this elegant elderly, you know, great beloved genius came on and gave these extraordinary renditions of all of his marvelous songs. And I remember turning to the friend I was with and kind of, we were thinking to ourselves, is it just us or is this the greatest gig ever? And then what I noticed afterward, in the wake of those gigs, everybody else seemed to be saying the same thing. And we were like, oh no, it wasn't just us. These gigs were extraordinary. He just had such charm, such magnetism, such, again, humanity. I mean, I've been a lifelong lover of his art and his music and his struggle, really. I think that's why people found him until, you know, his death a year or so ago so compelling, is that his art, his music is the document of his own intense struggles as a human being. And, you know, that struggle is really just being alive, isn't it? And so that's why the songs are so relatable. So that was unforgettable.
We actually have part of him at the Royal Hospital Kilmainham in that month in 2008. And this is where he sung Hallelujah.
I did my best, it wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I learned to touch. I've told the truth, I didn't come all this way just to fool you. And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand right here before the Lord of Song with nothing, nothing on my tongue but
Rob Doyle, it strikes me listening to that as well that he wasn't a man, even that at an advanced stage of his career, somebody who many people felt was doing it because he wanted to make back money that he lost. He wasn't going through the motions. He was actually really putting everything into that.
Yeah, you see, I ended up reading a biography or two in the years subsequent to those gigs, and I think there was that element that he had been ripped off, I suppose, while he was away in the monastery as a Buddhist monk, and he came down and all his money was gone. I can't remember the details of it, but sort of was that element that he needed to kind of go back to recoup some of his income. At the same time, by all accounts, he decided, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to give people
do it properly
a night to remember. And I think it wasn't just those gigs in Ireland. I think that entire tour was mythical, and he just went for it, and it was just very moving, you know, and the musicians he had with him, everything about it was just sublime, really.
Okay, we also asked you to pick out the first single you can remember buying. You went for a cassette single from the Presidents of the USA and the song Peaches. Why?
Yeah, I wonder, do many people remember that song? But I don't know. I can't remember why, just that I must have heard it on MTV. I think I came to music a bit late, in that it was only in my early teens that I really started, you know, some people, maybe that's the age people get into music, but that was when I really started to get into music. And, you know, I was watching MTV and just trying to find out what I liked, and I heard that song Peaches, and it was great. It was a mixture of melody and punk and energy, and so I ended up really liking that band.
Let's hear it.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Peaches come from a can.
A good bit older than you, Rob, but I actually haven't heard that song in years, but I used to love it at the time. Yes. From the grunge of the 90s.
Yeah,
great
yeah.
stuff.
And it had a melody. It had a pop edge to it too, you know.
We asked you for favourite act or favourite band. You've gone for Bright Eyes.
Yeah, well, that would be the songwriter Conor Oberst and his band, which they're kind of, I think they've just reformed, but they haven't really played for the best part of a decade. He's had his solo career equally compelling, but he's, I guess the really lazy and quick way to say it is, I feel like he's almost doing what Bob Dylan did for the 60s generation, for, you know, the the 21st century in just that he's just a songwriter of great genius and flair and lyricism, very prodigious. You know, he seems to have an album out every year or two, and the standard tends not to dip.
Let's hear First Day of My Life.
This is the first day of my life. Swear I was born right in the doorway. I went out in the rain, suddenly everything changed. They're spreading blankets on the beach. Yours is the first face that I saw. I think I was blind before I met you. And I don't know where I am, I don't know where I've been, but I know where I want to go. And so I thought I'd let you know. Yeah, these things take forever, I especially am slow. But I realized that I need you, and I wondered if I
Conor Oberst, Rob Doyle, author of Threshold. Thank you very much for being with us here on the Culture Club on Today FM today.
The last word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
And Volkswagen. Introducing the ID3, the next word in electric vehicles.
Andy O'Donoghue is with us for Tech Tuesday, and we're going to talk about sustainable and ethical smartphones, because in common with an awful lot of the electronic equipment that we use in our life today, they're not necessarily come from a production point of view, an ethical background, are they? And then getting rid of them, disposing with them after use, becomes an environmental issue.
There's no doubt that the spotlight has been cast, Matt, on smartphone manufacture particularly, because there are so many components in there and there are so many minerals. There are materials like cobalt, and 60% of the world's cobalt is located in the Congo. And as a result, people work often in terrible conditions, and it's you have this conflict nature to it, and so you have gangs vying to get the cobalt out of the ground.
So people are actually being paid minimal wages, not minimum wages, but minimal wages, practically
to
nothing,
live, practically.
And then somebody makes a big chunk of money, possibly who's using violence to do so, to export it to places like China, where they're then manufactured into a phone. But again, the manufacturing conditions are often abysmal.
Often so. And it's not just cobalt. Tungsten and tin also have problems attached to them as well. So over the last while, and this idea of the circular economy, the idea of not throwing out tech devices or even your fridge or your television, finding a repairman, repairing them, has all sort of formed an interesting industry. And a company called Fairphone have teamed up with Vodafone. And so now customers in UK and Ireland, Germany, Italy and Spain are going to be able to buy the Fairphone 3.
You have one in front of you now.
I do. And if you look at it, it looks quite like an iPhone 7 or 8, that sort
even
of
even though it's an Android
era.
Run phone, isn't it?
It's an Android phone. Interestingly, it doesn't come with a charger, comes in a cardboard box, and it comes with a very small screwdriver. And the idea of this is that as components, if the phone fails, or if you want to get a new battery, and of course, as you know, if you bring your expensive smartphone in, it's going to cost you €100 or more. But you can open this and you can replace seven components, including the screen, the camera, the battery and others. And if the camera gets an upgrade, you can buy a new camera. And on the Fairphone website, they're very reasonably priced. So the idea is to make this a phone that isn't just ethically produced.
Yeah, because are all the parts ethically sourced? Yeah. And then where is it manufactured?
Fairphone are a Dutch company, and they have gone to extreme lengths to make this an ethical phone. Fairtrade source the gold. They confirm that they use conflict-free tin and tungsten, and I think 60% of the plastic is has been made from recycled. So,
and you say it doesn't come with a plug. Does that mean that the plug for your old phone should be able to work with it?
It uses USB-C, and I suppose part of it is cost and part of it is just limiting the amount of manufacture that goes into the phone. And you know, this is a really radical idea, because this is a phone that I think it'll last at least 5 years in my reckoning.
Because what do most phones normally last for? 2 years?
People are changing them after 2 years.
Now, hang on, they're changing them, but do they need to change them? How long should they last for?
Well, they do last longer, but performance is often degraded. And so this is a really interesting idea that I think they've come up with. It's not cheap, and you can get it, with Vodafone on plans, if you have a good plan. You can get it for free, but I think it's $4.29 if you buy it SIM-free or pay-as-you-go.
What's its performance like, though?
It's pretty good. It's got a decent Snapdragon phone in it. It's like a phone that I would have used maybe a year and a half ago. So it's mid-range performance, but if you're willing to put your green credentials first, and if you're willing not to subscribe to the rampant consumerism in technology that we've experienced in the last 5 years, this is the sort of phone that doesn't just do a good job, but it's also a badge of commitment.
Where do old phones go to? Do they just go to landfill, or can they be recycled in any way?
Well, you should try to recycle your phone and do some good with it. There are organisations like Lisa Domican, who's been on your show, and the Grace app. They recycle old phones, iOS, Android, for children with autism. And they have an app that's a very good app, but that's a great way to recycle. And companies like Apple allow you to recycle your phone with them, and they go into a destruction process. Many of them do, of course, get worked on and end up for sale in other markets.
Okay, you have one of those phones now. Are they readily available at present?
I don't think they've gone on sale yet. It's early this year they're going on sale.
Through Vodafone stores, is it?
Through Vodafone, yeah.
Okay. Look, there are other ethical and sustainable tech I want to talk to you maybe in another week, but I just wanted to concentrate on smartphones, given that nearly everyone has one now.
Well, we have more phones in this country. There are more phones in this country than there are people, which is fascinating.
I wonder how many of them are broken and lying in drawers somewhere.
Well, I think probably what's happened is you do find in families that phones do get recycled down a family. So a parent will pass them on to children and teenagers. And, that's a good habit to have.
It's the only affordable one too. Andy O'Donoghue, thank you very much for joining us here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
And Volkswagen. Introducing the ID3, the next word in electric vehicles.
Okay, we decided we'd devote some time to the death of Terry Jones, one of the original cast members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And the man who directed Monty Python's The Life of Brian, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. Let's hear him talking on Conan O'Brien's talk show in 1994 when he discussed how one of those movies had got banned here in Ireland.
A number of films you've directed have actually been banned. Is that true?
Mm. Well, Life of Brian was banned in several states in the South, in America. In England, it got banned in certain cities. So, like in South Wales, it was banned in Cardiff, but not in Swansea. So everybody was bussed from one city in the cinema and bussed people to the other city. But in Ireland, Life of Brian was banned. The Meaning of Life, which was the next film we made, was banned. Okay. And then the next film I made was called Personal Services, and that was also banned in Ireland. Now, it happened at that time that they'd only ever banned four films in Ireland, and I'd made three of them.
You're on a roll.
In fairness, I think there were loads more movies banned in Ireland,
weren't
there?
Oh, Jesus, there were.
More than four over the years. But to hear what all the fuss is about, Terry Jones, as well as directing The Life of Brian, also played Brian's mother in this. So let's hear a little bit of that.
Hello, Mother.
Don't you hello, Mother, me. What are all those people doing out there?
Oh, well,
come on, what have you been up to, my lad?
I think they must have popped by for something.
Popped by? Swarmed by, more like. There's a multitude out there.
They started following me yesterday.
Well, they can stop following you right now. Now, stop following my son. You ought to be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, I love that film. I really do.
And of course, the other voice there was Graham Chapman, who's the other member of Monty Python, who's passed away. He died back in 1989. So,
And there's a brilliant clip on YouTube as well of John Cleese delivering the eulogy at Graham Chapman's funeral. And it's brilliant. And he basically says, like, I obviously I can't use the language that he uses, but he basically, like, curses out Graham Chapman from the actual pulpit in the church. And he makes the point that, like, you know, as much as anyone, Graham Chapman would have wanted his funeral to be the first place where someone was told to F off and that they hated the person who had died.
Or, no, piss off.
Or piss off or whatever. Yeah, I didn't want to, like, you said it, not me, you know, so I didn't want to get in trouble. But, yeah, no, I mean, I don't know if anybody saw it as well. There was Michael Palin was interviewed by BBC today.
We actually have a clip, I think, of that. We have some of the tribute that Michael Palin played or paid to Terry Jones.
Sort of like losing a limb, you know. I've known Terry since I met him at university in 1962, I think, and we performed at the Edinburgh Festival, the first time we actually wrote and performed material together, in 1964. And we're inseparable for many, many years after that, writing, acting through the Python times. And even in the last few years, when Terry was doing his thing, I was doing my thing, we'd still meet up. We were still very close friends, and I valued Terry's opinion probably more than any other. He was very, very astute. Terry didn't do private particularly. Terry was a very open man. He talked to you about absolutely anything. So what you see in really the characters that he plays, that sort of slightly manic, but always rather sort of warm and enthusiastic characters that he used to play, were very much Terry.
Michael Palin paying tribute. What is it about the life of Brian, though, you think that's still... What was the year was it made? Was it 1979?
No, 1970...
79, yeah, it was.
79, was it, yeah.
What is it about it that people love still so much?
I think it's the fact that it's so earnestly and violently throws its nose up at the idea of organized religion. I think that's really what kind of resonates still to this day. It has absolutely no respect for it whatsoever. But it's funny though, when you actually go back and watch it, any of the times where Jesus is mentioned, it's actually taken straight from the Bible. Like the first time you see Jesus, it's an absolute replication of the Bethlehem, and then when you see him and when he's doing the Beatitudes, I mean, any of the characters that encounter Jesus, it's adjacent to it. They're not actually making fun of Jesus, they're making fun of people around it. Well, yeah, Brian, but I mean, that's the idea of like, it's the idea of like how easily people are followed.
It was blasphemous here in Ireland. I mean, there was outrage about it at the time. This was blasphemy.
Yeah, but like, but that's just it.
It was also the age of the VHS, which is why the movie was
seen got around it,
by so many teenagers in particular at the time and young adults.
Same as, like, I mean, that's how I saw it. Like, I didn't see The Life of Brian in the cinema. I saw it, like, when we went down to the local Sunset Video in Clane and rented it. Like,
yeah. I mean, Monty Python just got like that silly, absurdist comedy so brilliantly, and a lot of people like cite Life of Brian as, you know, their favourite Monty Python film, but Holy Grail is also just a brilliant, brilliant film. Like, even I just watched it again a few months ago, and it really has, there's something about
it
that's aged so well. There's the coconuts, there's that whole bit with the, you know, the knight
French.
Who gets all his like limbs chopped off, 'tis only a scratch, or the Knights of Nith, which was actually a sketch from Terry Jones.
We have a clip. Well, we have a clip which we have to do the usual language warning here. Some listeners may find this offensive. It's starting to sound like a Sky football commentator. Anyway, this is where King Arthur and the knights are attacked by a killer rabbit.
Oh, brilliant.
Behold the cave of Caer Fanor.
Right. Keep me covered. What with? Just keep me covered.
Too late. There he is.
What, behind the rabbit?
It is the rabbit.
You silly sod!
What?
You got us all worked up!
Well, that's no ordinary rabbit. Oh. That's the most foul, cruel and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on.
You tit! I saw my arm and I was so scared.
Look, that rabbit's got a vicious streak a mile wide. It's a killer.
Get stuck.
He'll do you a treat, mate.
Oh, yeah? Manky Scots git.
I'm warning you.
What's he do? Nibble your bum?
He's got huge, sharp... He can leap about... Look at the bones!
Go on, boars, chop his head off.
Right,
silly little bleeder. One rabbit, two, coming right up.
Look!
Jesus Christ!
The
warned you.
The best bit about it is, though, is like when you actually see like the rabbit coming straight from, like, you know right well it's just like a tiny little puppet, but that's almost funny. It just adds funny.
But like, they cut between the puppet and like the actual like real bunny just like hopping around. It's so well done. Like, imagine if they'd had a proper budget for that. It just would not have worked.
It worked, yeah, yeah, completely. Like, even the fact that, like, yeah, the whole thing about the coconuts, that came about because they didn't have money for real horses. So, like, of course we're going to just get, like, a lad banging together coconuts and it'll work. Like,
And then The Meaning of Life was also banned in Ireland. There was one extraordinary scene as well, which he played it himself, in which the character exploded after...
Mr. Creosote.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
One of the disgusting, revolting scenes ever seen.
Oh, it's so gross.
It's so disgusting, yeah. And, like, the whole thing of, like, it's only a wafer thing when he tries to get him to eat the thing. Yeah, like, as much as there was that absurdist humour, there was also, like, really disgusting, gross-out humour as well. Like,
I mean, they kind of laid the foundations for comedy, I think, to the present day, really.
Yeah.
Like, you have to give them so much credit, Monty Python. Like, such an incredible troupe.
From everything from, like, you know, like, South Park, you know, that definitely took inspiration from Terry Gilliam. You look at something like Tim and Eric, or any of that kind of like really like absurd Adult Swim comedy.
Family Guy even.
Family Guy, yeah. Even. Like, it was, they were very much the originators of it.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play out on a bit of the most famous iconic music from Monty Python, from The Life of Brian. Yes, you know what I'm going to play.
It's a big football chant as well, I hear.
There you go.
Yes.
Brian Lloyd and Deirdre Malumby from entertainment.ie, thank you for joining us. So let's play out with Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Cheer up, Brian. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. Help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgot, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on! Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. About your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, your life chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life.
The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
And Volkswagen. Introducing the ID3, the next word in electric vehicles.
Michael Sheridan is with us, and he's been having a look at the Dundeal.ie annual survey of car sales in 2019 and some interesting developments when it comes to the increasing popularity of electric and hybrid cars.
True, Matt. There's been an exponential growth. The percentage figure is very high. The numbers are still relatively low compared to everything else, but people are shifting because they're more aware of the benefits to having an electric car, but also you've got one of the leaders and one of the biggest car companies in Ireland and in the world, Toyota, pushing its product range, and its product range is virtually all hybrid. So you're going to have no choice but to buy a hybrid if you go into a Toyota dealership, and they have dealerships all over the country. And I think in terms of this report, Toyota is particularly strong in Ulster. You've got Volkswagen, who's the number one brand last year. They sold the most vehicles last year. They're sort of Leinster and Connacht. And then down south, Ford, not surprisingly, is probably the most popular vehicle.
Say, not surprisingly, despite the fact that Ford has gone as
yeah, it's gone
manufacturing car last, for nearly 40 years.
Yeah, the last one was the Sierra, put in the mid-80s. 83, something like that. There's still loyalty there. Now, Ford have been pretty slow at bringing hybrids to the market. They've got the hybrid Mondeo, which is it's a lovely thing to drive, but it missed the boat. Mondeo itself was launched later than it was should. It was delayed. And then the hybrid was launched a number of years later. And it was never really exceptional at anything. You lost too much boot space, but it was still a nice car to drive and very well priced. And what we've seen with the shift to car companies being more aware of emissions, we've seen a lot of diesel engines and petrol engines fall off the price list completely because they can't make them so that they emit acceptable amounts of CO2. And then the hybrid option is often the only way.
Yeah, just under 15,000 new and electrical hybrid cars sold at a time when the overall market was down nearly 7%.
Yeah, the one area that did very well, and it's funny, we're at a really critical point in time now because come the end of the month and Brexit, we're going to just see a sudden screech and a handbrake go on to imports. We had a huge amount of imports. I think there was over 108,000.
Will there really be that screech and a break, given that there will still be the normal trading arrangements for the rest of 2020? It's not like there are going to be tariffs or anything like that coming down.
The thing is that everybody is aware of the NOx tax that came in on the 1st of January, and this was penalising cars if they produced NOx. Now, NOx is made when you have particularly, but both fuel types produce NOx. A petrol engine will produce NOx and so will a diesel engine. Diesel engines will produce that bit more when they're generating power. So if you have a powerful car, if you have an engine that's under hard acceleration, it as a byproduct, it produces more nitrogen oxide. And older versions that didn't meet European regulations, and they're the cars that we've been buying in our droves when we go across the UK. And you can see why the Volkswagen Golf is hugely popular, and that would be the diesel version coming in. Older versions didn't have the same after treatment. So once the engine had made the power, it would then go through just a straightforward exhaust. Later on, you got diesel particulate filters. You got AdBlue tanks on Euro 6 versions. So they cleaned up their act quite a good bit. So they're not penalised as much, but they're much newer cars. So you're going to have to spend more to get one of those to bring it in. What everybody was doing was going over and bagging a bargain, because in the UK, they sell, something like 2.2 million cars every year. So there's a much bigger market over there. But we will see a rise again in the value of used cars in Ireland, because the whole cough with importing cars is going to be softened. And particularly with dealers, will have to pay VAT and VRT when they import the car directly, as opposed to deferring it. So that'll slow down that trade a lot as well.
The new car sales done last year, has there been a move back to petrol?
You know what?
Obviously.
It's within, I think, 6% of diesel. Diesel is still the most popular fuel. And for many people, diesel is absolutely still the way to go for your transport. The current crop of new diesels produce very little CO2, a lot less than a petrol engine. They produce very little NOx. They generally produce a tiny bit more than a petrol engine, but the current crop produce very little because all the manufacturers are being compliant with European regulations, which every year is insisting on stricter and stricter controls, and that manufacturers have to have average emissions coming out of their tailpipe, which are getting greener and greener and greener. So we've seen a rise in automatics as well over manuals, and that's as a result of hybrids. So in the main, but also automatic gearboxes now are much easier to make and more economical than ever before. When I was a child growing up, you only had an automatic gearbox and a big Jag or a big Mercedes, and it was a big heavy thing. It needed separate oil and all this sort of stuff. They were terrible. They used to take a lot of fuel and everything else. But now they're ultra light, and many automatics are actually more efficient than their manual version. All hybrids, which is usually 99% of the time a petrol engine and a part quasi-electric component, which is an electric motor which kicks in now and again, and a battery pack, they have to run. To combine that electric motor and engine, you need an automatic gearbox to do it. It's all very technical, but it makes ease of use in traffic very, very nice. And we've seen a massive increase in autos because of the adoption of hybrids and electric cars.
I noticed that 43 or 46% of car buyers, according to a survey by Dundee, say they pay cash.
Yeah, this kind of surprised me a bit because there's such good deals on finance, and you know, between higher purchase and PCP and all the like, that there's still people with cash down the back of the sofa and under the mattress. And when you consider, you know, if the average price of a new car is in the mid-20s, That's a lot of cash to have to hand, and it's remarkable, and it surprised me a lot. Another couple of things that were interesting in it. I know in Dundeel there's a lot of car after sellers out there. Dundeel's the biggest. I think they have a new car listed every minute, but the fact that people's searches have changed, so people are searching now for hybrids and electric cars far more than they were. And only a number of years ago was pointed out to me that, you know, 10 years ago, maybe 3 electric cars were sold. And now, you know, you're looking at the guts of 3,000. And those numbers are increasing all the time. And as the manufacturers slowly deliver us more onto the pallet and onto the menu, people will be choosing this option in an effort to get around the sort of that 2030 scare that was given to us. And let's hope that soon policy is dropped and it's just something more reasonable, like saying we commit to honouring what Europe says cars should emit in terms of pollutants by 2030.
Okay, and then new car registrations. What parts of the country are they strongest in and not?
Well, Dublin is still massive. Cork is the second largest market, but Dublin, I think, is 4 times the Cork in terms of people wanting their cars. And the funny thing is, after you buy a car, a used car with a D-reg has the most value. You'll retain most value if you've got a D-reg on it, because that's the kind of the largest market for it. So you're sort of blending in with the crowd more. Whereas if you want to buy your Rolls Royce and have a Leitrim reg, you better own Leitrim, because your second hand value is not worth as much as a D-reg on it.
I wonder how many brand new cars are out there. I've only seen one car with a 20 reg on it so far.
You saw me. Must have seen me pulling up testing something. Yeah, there is a few, because again, the way with our new registration system, we have 201, and then we'll 6 months in we'll have 202. All of the buying and selling happens in October, November, and the registrations happen, and then there's a rush to get cars registered, and there's a whole glut of them then, which are being delivered and handed over at the moment. Literally, you'll have dealerships working night and day, for this entire month and well into the end of February, bending over backwards, delivering new cars. So you will see a chunk of them. And it's a nice looking plate as well. I think the 202 might even look better, but it's a good plate, but you will see them. You will see them.
A listener says the cash in hand thing, is that a tax avoidance issue when people are buying cars?
I don't know. But again, a lot of people, you see, if you're doing a PCP deal or a finance deal, you can reduce your monthly payments by paying off a good wadge in terms of a deposit. So I reckon a lot of cash would go to that, because you might necessarily have, you'd need to find maybe 10 grand in cash as a deposit or trade in your car in order to get a very low monthly payment on a brand new car. But as we've said before, it's well worth investing in the new machinery, particularly when they're loaded up with safety equipment. And you'll see a lot of that. And then people are, last year we became very aware of bargains. And you look at Dacia, the budget arm of Renault, it had over a 14% growth. It had a massive jump in sales. And a number of companies managed just to stay the same. A lot depends. It's cyclical on whether they've got new models or they've done pushes, or if a model has been delivered in time for January registrations or July registrations and so on.
Michael Sheridan, as ever, thank you very much for joining us. So that's it for today's show. You can find many other highlights from the show on our podcast page on sayfm.com or wherever you get your podcasts from. And you can get our political coverage from the election during the week there as well. We'll be back Monday to Friday next week, 4:30 to 7:00. In the meantime, enjoy the weekend.